Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 70. SBIR Funding, the Business of Science.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. Today, we are going to do something we haven't done at all in the 70 episodes that we've covered. Almost everything has been science, biotech. We've done a little space science. Now we're going to cover business. And I think our conversation today is important in that if you want to really innovate and bring new technologies to market, including biotechnologies, you have to create new organizational structures, and that could be founding a company. And one may ask, how do you find a company? Do you find, are the VCs are just going to give money right up front for no technology? No. You need to develop that technology, and one of the ways to do it is to apply for a small business innovation research grant. Fairly recently, about a month ago, I sat in a two-day seminar from our guest that our guest presented, and it was it took me 4 years to learn what was taught to us in 2 days and what will probably be taught to us here on Futures in Biotech in an hour. Well, this will be a good start. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our only second guest that doesn't have a PhD. She has a master's in biomedical engineering and an enormous amount of experience in 70 shows. So it's a very huge honor to have Lisa Kurek. She's a managing partner, biotechnology business consultant in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she knows more about grants than every scientist I've ever met. And she can help you get your company started. So if you ever had a thought, now this doesn't only apply to biotech, it applies to all forms of technology. So if you want to start a technology company, this is where to start. This is the, just learn from Lisa. So welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Mark. I'm glad to be here. I'm honored. It sounds like the bar is pretty high.
Well, you presented 16 hours.
I presented 16 hours, and I probably that week did it for 4 days, 2 days at one place and 2 days in another. So I have a great time teaching people all about the Small Business Innovation Research Grant Program. I'm thrilled for biotech technologies. I'm an engineer by training, but I decided it was a whole lot more fun to help other people get their technologies to market. So I've been doing it for quite a while, and it's a lot of fun. And I hope I can give a lot of information on getting some free money.
Well, that's kind of, I don't want to sound too much like an infomercial here, but, you know, this is a process. Isn't it a process? Why do these small business innovation research grants, why are they out there?
So this is a really good question and maybe a good place for us to start. You mentioned the concept of switching over to talk about business instead of science. And in fact, here at BBC, we focus on what we call the business of science and the business of biotechnology. And one of the frameworks that we lay down is the fact that there's no such thing as build it and they will come. And although most of the scientists we work with, many come out of industry, many more come out of academia, and they all have great ideas. And there's a general misconception that all it takes is a great idea to commercialize product. And if that were the case, there would be a whole lot of very wealthy academics right now. So the reason the Small Business Innovation Research Program exists is, in snapshot, kind of the following. If you look at money out there to build a company and get product to market, there's a lot of risk in building a technology company. So whether it's a pharmaceutical or a new medical device, you've got the risk that the market may or may not adopt the product. You've got the risk of managing your company. And you also have the risk of getting the technology to work. And in the capital markets, at least for the last 20 years, there's been money, whether it's venture capital, angel capital, corporate capital, that's been willing to take market risk, willing to take management risk. But the kind of catch-22 for technology entrepreneurs is when investors say, oh, well, that's a great idea. Bring me the prototype or give me the clinical data if you're developing a clinical product, and then I'll be interested in funding it. So there's the question of how do you get money to get the technology far enough along in the development that other forms of capital are willing to take a risk. And so the federal government actually puts money towards this program, and it's very unusual because it's very hard to find forms of capital from governments, nonprofits, so what we call non-dilutive funding or free money. And it does sound cheesy, but it's free money. And there's not a lot of free money from the government out there for for-profit companies. In this case, if you're a small company, and there's a very specific definition, which we can get to later on if you want, relative to what type of small company, and you're developing technologies, and there's a lot of risk in the technology, but if you can make the statement, oh, if only I could get this technology to work, then I've got a great market opportunity to solve a really important problem. If it's biotech, maybe it's a problem of curing a disease, diagnosing a disease. Then the SBIR program can fill that gap by providing non-dilutive funding to technology-based companies to help get the technology to work so that it can get to market. Was that a good start?
It was awesome. So, in fact... You know, I have to preface this with the fact that I did start my company. We spun out a technology from Yale that was very early stage, very, very early stage. And this allowed us to raise enough capital to create a company with an employee of one, me, and rent some space and get the resources to get the research materials that we needed to move the project along. Is that normal? I mean, can you create a company on paper if you have a really good idea? Is it really risky? Well, there's no risk, I guess, to this, right? And then go through the program.
So the program requires that a company be established. So you can't apply for the money and then, if you get the money, go ahead and start a company. So you have to have a small company. And there's different ways you can go about doing that. So you chose, when you left Yale, to start your own company. And that's one way to do it. And when you apply for this money, the company has to meet certain eligibility requirements relative to who owns the company. But you don't actually have to start operations until and unless you get the funding, at which point you make sure that you've got employee at least one and space. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it, and some of these grants are awarded, and their contracts also are awarded to existing companies. So if you're an existing company, you might already have product on the market. If you meet the eligibility requirements and you have a new generation or a completely new technology that you want to develop, you can also use this funding to help support the development of new high-risk technology products. So you can come at it from either way, but it's an exceptional way to start a company, and it's often the first money into the company. Rarely, if ever, the only money ultimately into the company, but it definitely can be the first money. And just as you say, it can help support that first technical position with the first research laboratory rent available to get the technology moving forward.
Well, what I did really is I just went to the Secretary of State's office and hand-delivered an application to form an LLC. So I think it cost me $60 in Connecticut. We went through the application process, got through review, then they asked us for a considerable amount of, you know, proof that we had a company, because really I had a bench at Yale and it was just a postdoc thing, and so we stepped out. It is feasible though to, you know, form an LLC and then to you know, call your Secretary of State's office, get an EIN number, a tax ID number. What are some of the elements that are required in the first application? What are the criteria? So you mentioned that the company has to exist, so you have to form a company or be part of a company. But what are some of the essential elements?
So from the standpoint of the project or from the standpoint of the eligibility of the company, or do you want to go through both?
Let's start. Yeah, we'll go to the projects later and grant okay. strategy after, but you know, the, okay. just a framework, because we have a TWIT audience here. This audience is 8 times more likely to have a PhD. It's a very, very smart audience. There are a lot of researchers who might have an academic research program, but have some ideas that they want to translate either to clinic or off the engineering bench into the market. This is where they're coming from. Somewhat like the audience that you had over here at BioEnterprise.
Yeah. So let's start maybe from the mechanics of it. So yes, you can go to your Secretary of State's and you can start a company. There's two aspects to securing this type of funding. The company that you create has to meet certain eligibility requirements. So let's start there just very briefly. It has to be small. You have to have less than 500 employees. So in your case, that was not an issue. You have to be located in the United States. You have to do all of the work in the United States that you get the government's money from. You have to be owned by U.S. citizens, individuals who are U.S. citizens, so you can't be foreign owned and you can't be institutionally owned. So, for example, if you have a company that's already secured a fair bit of venture capital and the venture capital fund owns most of your company, that would not be eligible. If you are an individual or 5 or 10 individuals and you own a chunk of the company and then there's a minority interest by investors, that would be okay. And then lastly, and this is the thing that sometimes causes the PhD academic sector of the eligible applicants to have some problems, you actually are going to have a laboratory that the company controls to do the work in if you're funded. So the corollary to that is you can't be a virtual company. So when you went out and you set up your company at the Secretary of State's office, you were virtual. And that's okay when you apply. But when you are actually getting ready to get funded, if they want to fund you, you have to rent space and put your company and its one or more employees into that space to do some of the work.
Mm-hmm. We did.
One other
did
thing that. I'll point out. Yeah. And then we can, so that meets the rules. But then there's another aspect. The other aspect is that once the company meets the eligibility rules and you write a proposal, it's going to go in and the agency and in whatever process they review the proposal has to make a decision as to whether or not to fund you. And one of the things they're going to use to make that decision, in addition to the problem you're trying to solve, is it important, the product you're developing, the technology that underlies the product, are the people and the facilities. So when you're a virtual company at application, you still have to identify the people and the facilities that will move into that company if you're funded so that the reviewers can assess whether or not you've got the right project, the right team, the right facilities, particularly in biotech where facilities can be somewhat expensive. So you need, thinking for that was the word, you know, expensive. You need wet lab, you often need robotics, you might need animals. So, you know, there's the issue of identifying space depending on where you're located. Sometimes it's easy when there are a lot of incubators. Sometimes not so easy when you're a community where there's not a lot of wet lab space. So those are some of the things you have to take into consideration. Some has to be done up front. Some is going to be necessary for the agency to make an assessment as to whether or not they want to fund you. And then some of it can be done when you're going to get the money.
You know, this is really, really exciting because it's, you know, the birth of a new company, basically, that you can personally own. Now, not everybody here is going to be applying for, you know, biotechnology. There's a lot of software developers and engineers, you know, computer scientists and people of all backgrounds with technical mind. You know, the cost of entry for a software developer would be a laptop and a few coffees at Starbucks. Would that be enough? Can you form an LLC? Or do you have to have physical space? Absolutely.
You have to have physical space. But what the terminology is, if you read the legal description, is company controlled research space suitable to do the work proposed. So that's kind of a mouthful. But if we break it down, company controlled research space, Starbucks isn't in the company's control. Okay. Right. And it's also not research space. Now, if you're an IT company, your research space might be, you know, a 6x8 cubicle with your computer, which might not work so well if you're a wet lab company. So, and that 6x8 cubicle could be in a incubator that you rent. I get asked by people a lot of the time, well, what about if it's in my house? is while your house might meet the requirements of company-controlled research space, reviewers might look at it and go, working in their house, are they a real company? But so, you know, that's kind of where the objective and then the subjective criteria come in. But Starbucks would never work.
Well, we went to our university's tech transfer office and said, do you have space? Is there space available? And they said, well, if you go across town, there's some labs there and you might be able to rent some space. So we went around and one lab said, yes, we'll give you that space. It's one bench. And so I took photos of the bench and they said, yeah, you could use our cell culture room if you want. We'll include it as part of the rent. So then I took pictures of their cell culture facility. And then I, you guys have a centrifuge? Yeah, they're perfect. Took photos around. And the rent wasn't cheap and certainly much cheaper in Cleveland. So Cleveland was a real godsend when it comes to running a small business compared to the New Haven area. But so that was kind of the framework I did, but I suppose an office, you know, if you're doing software, you could just rent a one room office, 100 square feet, 10 by 10, and that would be a. What about the, you know, the financial backings? What are traditionally required? You know, they want a company that exists. If you just form an LLC and you're minus 200 because you just paid the rent for the first month, minus 300, I mean, that could disqualify you, right? Because they look at your balance sheet.
What the agency is going to look at the time of award is if you are able financially, both from a financial health perspective and a financial management perspective, to handle the government's money. So there's no requirement that you have $2 or $2 million in the bank. The requirement is that you have the necessary financial control systems. You've got a good bookkeeping and accounting set up. You have no... negative, you know, you have no, the company is a healthy company. It can be healthy and new. It can be healthy with not much money, but it has to be a healthy company and it has to have the right administrative infrastructure to be able to take the government's money. This is not hard, but it's something that you have to be cognizant of and make sure that you get the right assistance if it looks like you're going to get this money. The agencies will typically make an assumption at the time of assessment of the project that you're okay, but before they'll fund you, depending on the agency, and there are actually 11 agencies that have this SBIR funding available, before they actually fund you, each agency will have its own methods for assessing whether or not your company is healthy enough to take their money and use it properly.
So that would mean a bank account, maybe a credit line?
You have to have a bank account. You have to have a bank account. You'll have to have a bank account, and they'd like to know if you have a credit line. There's not a requirement to have a credit line, but they'd like to know that you will have to have a bank account just because to do business with the government. Now, the government requires anyone doing business with them have a bank account. It has to be a corporate bank account. It has to be set up in the EIN number of your company, so it can't be your personal bank account. But to my knowledge, they're not going to look and see how much money you've got in that bank account. They're going to look to see if you have the ability to handle their money right financial systems. Yeah.
Now,
one of the other things that might be worth pointing out when you talked about identifying space is that we talked before about this being the first money sometimes into the company, but one thing that gets frustrating for folks who are starting a new company is they want to think that they can use this money for everything. And this is restricted money in the sense that what this money can be used for is to pay for the research and development that you propose. So whatever direct costs, your salaries, your supplies, your materials, it can pay for some indirect cost, which is rent and utilities and whatnot. And there's sometimes a small bit of profit or discretionary money. But what the money can't be used for, there's two things it can't be used for that can be frustrating to folks. Can't be used to do the business aspects. So it can't be used for your market research, your patents and whatnot. And it also can't be used to set up your general laboratory. So if when you went to look for that lab, you walked in and they said, hey, here's 15 feet of bench space, but you got to figure out how to get a centrifuge, how to get the water piped in, all the basics. They won't let you use the money for the basics. So it's often the case, and I hate entrepreneurs to be naive, that you're going to need other resources besides this money. Typically, to outfit your basic laboratory and then to help conduct some of the business associated activities you're going to need to do.
Well, that's, I guess, we didn't This is exactly, here's the fun part. And this is why when I went to your course, it sort of brought me on the straight and narrow. I didn't know that that was the rule, or not the rule, but the general understanding of a reviewer to say, well, if you don't have space, you don't have the necessary resources to do the project, that it's not the rules of the SBIR are not to set up your lab. And well, I didn't ever intend on buying a whole bunch of equipment, but borrow.
That's the cool thing about incubators and those kinds of facilities is that that's why I love communities with incubators and where there's a network of entrepreneurial companies. Because as long as you have some of your own space, the incubator can provide shared space, shared equipment. So it just can't all be shared. So that's the great thing about having that kind of infrastructure in your community.
Well, there was a company and they were in phase one clinical trial. So they completed their drug discovery and development phase. So they had the wet labs available and they were renting to a number of companies just to keep the building going. But all around the country, there's incubators. Almost every chamber of commerce can help you find resources that are tremendous space, office space that will be promised to you upon funding and a letter of support. Right. Yep. I'm here in Cleveland, but if I go up to Beechwood, there's a Chamber of Commerce, Shaker Heights Chamber of Commerce, Cleveland Chamber of Commerce that's sort of, and we're at BioEnterprise, but if I wasn't doing bio, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there. So you can get your ideas out there.
There are a lot of tech-based economic development organizations beyond just chambers of commerce now, too, all over the country. We work all over the country, and whether you're in, you know, like you said, Cleveland with BioEnterprise, or here in Ann Arbor, we've got something called Ann Arbor Spark. On the west side of the state, there's another economic development organization that focuses on technology-based economic development. And if you have those in your community, they're great at helping to find not only the tech, the space, but the technology community to plug you into of other entrepreneurs so you can start to share some of those, whether it's equipment or whether it's just ideas, and commiserate about, you know, the challenges of being an entrepreneur. There are a few.
Burke has just asked us to explain what incubators are. What exactly are incubators? It's kind of what you just said, but maybe so by definition, more like.
It's a broad concept, you know, so incubator essentially very loosely says there's a facility where one or more companies can essentially co-locate, and incubators will usually have some dedicated space for each individual company and then typically shared space. In the most basic iteration of an incubator, it's a real estate location. So it's a place where you can go, you can rent space, and maybe get some shared conference facilities. Maybe you're helping to pay, share the cost of some of the infrastructure, telephone, internet. Then you can start to find incubators, though, that are more specialized and that add services. Some might have business resources accessible to you, attorneys, accountants, and some might be technology-based incubators that provide specialized space, for example, for biotech companies and wet labs. So, and then some of them, the really robust incubators, will not only have business services, but they might have bring in speakers. They might have executives in residence who can help technology-based entrepreneurs with the business aspects of what they're doing. So it provides a community, it provides some infrastructure or resource facility, and then sometimes they provide some services.
So you've got now a bank account, you have a potential space, you called the IRS and you have an EIN number, an employee's identification number, because the first thing you do is you form a company. You definitely have to form an LLC or a C-class corp or an S-class. How would you pick? What's best for SBIR applications?
You know, that's a question that I would say it doesn't matter. From an SBIR perspective, the SBIR program doesn't care whether you're a C-corp, an S-corp, or an LLC. That's a decision that's more based on the type of business. There are tax implications for those. So that's something that your corporate attorney, and you, I hate to say it, but the minute you become an entrepreneur, you got to spend money on things like accountants and attorneys. But, you know, they should be able to advise you based on both tax issues, and also you want to ask yourself, what kind of company am I going to be in the future? Am I going to need to raise other kinds of money? Because sometimes the type of legal entity that you form will affect your fundraising abilities. But from an SBIR perspective, it doesn't matter. So you use your other business, type of business, and your business advisors to help you figure out what kind of company. And in the absence of any of those, you did what a lot will do, which is set up an LLC, which is kind of the basic, easiest, most flexible form to set up in the absence of any of the other criteria.
And but that company has to be American owned for the American program. Which
that's correct.
It has to be
U.S. owned, and that's defined U.S. owned by individuals. That's what we mentioned before. So one or more individuals, and an individual is a natural person. And I know that sounds kind of goofy. People look at me funny when I say that, but I've had lots of instances of organizations that are two or three person LLCs. You know, so Mark, you and I can pretend that we have a whole lot of money and we decided to throw our money together in a pot. And instead of you and I each investing individually, we put that money in collectively into some investments. If we put the money in the name of our LLC instead of in our individual names, we would no longer be counted as individuals. So I don't know if that made sense, but some people have an issue with that. So you need 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 people who are U.S. citizens or permanent residents to own at least 51%, and that's a way to define majority. And that will make you a U.S. eligible company. And the other up to 49% can be owned by foreign individuals, foreign entities, large corporations, universities, whoever, as long as we've got one or more natural persons who own up to 51% and they're U.S. citizens.
Let me just state here, take a step back, 37,000 feet. And, you know, to the audience here, this is an opportunity it's an amazing opportunity, Thomas Edison. Basically, if you're an inventor or an engineer and you really want to do it be an entrepreneur and do it yourself, this is how you do it. And some of these the advice that Lisa's giving us is, it's personally for my company has. And we'll talk a little bit about how this happens later on, but it changed our annual revenues by about $150,000 simply through understanding the SBIR program a little bit better. So I thank you for that. Now, there's a question from the chat room. Web1950 is asking, can you be a DBA sole proprietor?
Yes, you can. And now that's a good question. To my knowledge, yes, you can be a DBA sole proprietor. I don't know that that's the best entity to go in as, and I think you'd probably be better off setting up an LLC. But to my knowledge, there is no restriction against being a DBA sole proprietor. As long as you've got, it can't be your personal social security number. You need to have a corporate entity and be able to open up a corporate bank account. And I apologize, not being an attorney, I'm not real good at the nuances of the different legal structures. So that might be one we'd have to look into a little more. I have to tell you, in my experience, in 15 years of doing this, I don't think I've ever worked with a sole proprietor that's applied for this funding. But so I'd want to look into that a little bit more.
What is a DBA sole proprietor?
Well, a DBA is doing a business as. And one of the things you have to be careful at with this program is, depending on which of the agencies you're working with, there are a number of registrations you have to complete. And each time you make a change in something related to your company, a name, a corporate structure, you can kind of get messed up depending on where you're at in the process. So you want to really think about, one of the things I think it's really important is to stop and think about what the goals are relative to getting this technology to market. And you want to think about the fact that the SBIR funding, which is awesome, awesome money and will be probably enabling money to get a company going, is not going to be the only money or the only activity at some point you're going to have to do. And what you really want to do is think a little strategically. I'm not just, hey, I got this cool idea, I want to get this product out there, but what kind of company am I going to need to be? How are my customers going to be able to get this technology integrated and buy it when I'm down the road? And think a little bit more about setting this thing up right, so that as you get this money, you can really focus on developing the technology and grow very quickly.
All right.
So you put a strategy I'm kind of, up front.
This is really good advice too, though. So I'm thinking in frame in the mind of somebody who's not done, not started. So you form the company. By the way, there's comments in the chat room that say, just go to LegalZoom.com. It's really easy to form an LLC. You don't even need to. Go to the Secretary of State's office of your state. There's a form to download. It says, set up an LLC. It's a one pager. And all you need to do is write your name, write your home address. And you have to find a person who will be a legal representative basically, if there is a summons or a lawsuit, they know who to drop off the lawsuit to. So you put in a name of somebody you live with. It could be anybody. It has to be a resident of that state, and that's it. And usually, it's anywhere between $25 and $50. Ohio is $250, though. Ohio's a little bit more expensive. So it's you don't have to go to LegalZoom. You can if you want, but you just simply go to Secretary of State's office, download the form. And in Canada, by the way, there's proof of principle grants that are very similar to these SBIR grants. Now, we're using the terms and the rules for SBIRs, so they don't really apply exactly to the ones in Canada, but Canada has a very, very similar system, just a little bit smaller scale too. You've got your company, you've got your bank account. Sometimes they request a credit line just to show that you can pay for salaries during gap funding or during a period of administrative process. So yep. The grant money, sometimes they'll say, okay, it starts on January 1st, but then they'll only roll it out in March. Right. And you have to be able to cover those 3 months. A little bit of a credit line can help you do that. And then you pay off those bills as soon as the grant money's in. You have an EIN number that you get from the IRS. And then you go through some of the registration processes for one of the various agencies. Should we talk about agencies that have the money, or should we talk about, the general concept of commercializing a technology?
Let's do both. Maybe we can do both at the same time. So let's start from the premise that you have a great idea. The great idea is for a product. Now, people come at product development from one of two places. Scientists tend to come at it from, I've been working in the lab. I've, been understanding this field of science, and now I've had an aha moment, and I think, wow, I could turn this molecule into a therapy, or I could take this material and develop a nanosensor, or I could take this algorithm and start to have a really great application with data. Those tend to be what I refer to as technologies in search of a market. You got the flip side where you might be out in the field and you identify a very compelling problem and you go, wow, if only I could come up with a technology solution that could take this data and extract this information from it, then we could have a really critical product to solve a problem. And the reason it doesn't matter from an SBIR perspective, it doesn't matter. But what you have to do is build the whole story of I've got a technology that will enable a product that will solve an important problem in the market, okay? And you got to be able to tell that whole story. Then what you have to do is find an agency, and there are 11 agencies that have this funding, that have an interest in supporting that kind of technology development. And then you have a match. So the agencies, what they do with this program is they put out what's called a solicitation. So with this program, you can't just have a great idea and say, I have a great idea. I think the Department of Defense would be interested in it, and I'm going to send them a proposal. They're going to put out a solicitation and say, we're looking for small businesses to develop technologies in this particular area. With the 11 agencies that have the money, and I can list them off for you whenever you're ready, sure. The scope is really broad, okay? So it's really broad. In fact, I was doing a seminar with one of the National Science Foundation program directors, and he made the comment to the group. It was in a university. It was a group of 100 folks, and he said, if you can come up with a technology-based product idea that falls outside of the interest of the National Science Foundation, it's pretty out there. So you've got, in the big agencies, you've got Department of Defense, you've got the National Institutes of Health as part of the Health and Human Services. So that actually is National Institutes of Health, Centers for Disease Control, Food and Drug Administration. You've got National Science Foundation, you've got Department of Energy, you've got NASA, you've got Department of Commerce, you've got Department of Education, you've got Department of Homeland Security, Department of Transportation. They all participate in this program, and there are 11 of them. One of the things that is important to note, though, is that this program is a federal set-aside. Congress says to the agencies, if you have a big enough budget for extramural research, so that's a budget that funds the universities, that funds research outside of the agency, then you need to set aside a portion of it to fund small businesses through this SBIR program. The total amount of money that's available, and it's huge, is $2.5 billion a year, which I think is a pretty significant number. And one of the things I encourage folks to think about is, we get all excited about venture capital. Venture capital, angel money, so private capital has the discretion to invest or not. If it likes deals, it'll invest. If it doesn't like deals, it won't. Government, when an agency gets money, they spend it. They don't hold on. So you've got $2.5 billion a year distributed amongst these 11 agencies to fund this program. It's not distributed equally, though. So half of that budget, and it's because it's tied as a percentage of their overall research budget. So it's locked in congressionally. It's not discretionary. The agencies have to do this, not if they want to. The largest budget is with the Department of Defense, and that's almost half of the SBIR budget. It's a little under $1.2 billion. And then the next largest agency is Health and Human Services, and primarily represented by NIH, National Institutes of Health, with almost $690 million. And then the next three that have between $100 and $150 are Department of Energy, NASA, and the National Science Foundation. And those are the big five. And out of those, they represent the vast majority of that money. And I would think most of your listeners, if they've got a technology-based product idea, could probably find interest at one of those five agencies. What they have to make sure they do, though, is not say, fund my cool project. What you have to do is something like the following. There's an important problem. I don't care if it's an energy problem, if it's a healthcare-related problem, if it's a materials problem for making, you know, airplanes that disappear in the sky, whatever it is, you say there's a really important problem. I have a technology that could potentially solve this problem, and I have the ability to commercialize it if I can get the technology to work. And once you can tell that story, if it's something DOD is interested in, if it's something NIH is interested in, if it's something NSF is interested in, chances are there will be a solicitation out that you can respond to and put in a proposal to get money to develop that product. So it's kind of doing your homework up front and not just saying, fund my cool idea. It's saying, this should be funded because it could solve a really important problem. And it's a problem that one of those federal agencies is really interested in.
So you've got, it seems like you've got a yin and yang here. You've got major projects that these agencies, the Department of Defense, want solved. They say, by the way, is there anybody out there that can develop this product because we need it? But there's also, you're saying, you don't just say, fund my cool project. But what if you contact the Department of Defense, find the program official for one area of research? You just Google, you say, I work on brain trauma, so I found the brain trauma SBIR folk, DOD folk, and said, you know, what if you do this? Because a lot of, if you're doing research and you've got cutting edge technology, it may not be on the scope of the agency, right?
Yep. So there's two different kinds of agencies, and this is a really good kind of lead into that. Agencies like Department of Defense actually use a contracting mechanism with their SBIR dollars. And by that, I mean they generate ideas. They generate topics. Because we're the Department of Defense and we have a lot of needs and we procure a lot of things, and Congress has told us we have to spend this $1.2 billion on small businesses, let's come up with a list of topics, a list of very specific topics that we think small business will be well suited to develop. And so they will put their ideas out in a solicitation. To your point, if you're proactive enough, you can try and identify who within the Department of Defense, which, by the way, is a huge organization, Army, Navy, Air Force, and lots of other components. And you can try and say, hey, check it out, man. I got this technology and you should be interested in it, in the hopes of influencing them to come up with a topic. So that's one chunk of agency. And that's usually what we call our procurement agencies. Department of Defense, NASA, Department of Homeland Security is an example. But then we have a very, very different kind of agency on the other side, which are what I loosely refer to as the mission-driven agencies. National Institutes of Health wants to promote human health. National Science Foundation wants to advance science. And what they actually do is they put out these very broad solicitations that essentially say, and NIH is a good example, if you have any ideas in how you can develop products that would help promote human health, send them on in. And it's what we refer to as an investigator-initiated solicitation. So it's still a solicitation. You still have to wait for them to put out essentially a call for proposal. But their call for proposal will say, we want new therapeutics for disease. We want new diagnostics for disease. We want new medical devices. And we want anything else that you can think of that might help improve human health. So it depends on which agency and what your goals are, where there's a fit. Sometimes you can have a fit with both. But in the first case, you have to either influence a topic or opportunistically find a topic. Where in the latter case, you can apply to the National Institutes of Health whenever you're essentially ready. They have one big solicitation. It's open all year. It has three review cycles, but anytime you're ready within the next 2 to 3 months, there's an opportunity for you to submit to them. So big difference in the types of agencies. Unfortunately, with the SBIR program, think about it like customers. There are 11 federal agencies, and they all have different needs. So they take their SBIR dollars and put out somewhat differing solicitations. So it takes some time to sort through the different agencies and figure out how to work with them.
You said that it was about $2.5 billion for the various agencies, mostly through DOD, NIH, and Department of Energy.
Department of Energy, NASA, and National Science Foundation.
Okay. So with those agencies, roughly $2.2 billion or something like that. It's enormous amounts of money. How much money can you apply for? What is typically not result in a gag factor by the reviewers?
So it depends. So some agencies will have absolutely specifically prescribed limits. And in fact, all of the agencies do, except for the National Institutes of Health, which gives you some flexibility. The general guidelines, the Small Business Administration oversees this program, kind of the intermediary between Congress and the 11 agencies. And they put out a guideline. It's called the SBIR Policy Directive. And in it, so you have to take your project. And overall, this is approximately 3 years of funding. And overall, the guidelines are $1.15 million over 3 years. You have to apply in two steps. You have to propose what they call phase one feasibility study, which is typically 6 months and $150,000, followed by a two-year, typically $1 million R&D project. And the reason why they make you break it up in two pieces is if you go back a little earlier when we talked about the fact that this is risky technology, you know, the government is smart. They're treating it like other investors. If there's huge risk to your technology, which by the way is a very good thing for SBIR because they want to fund cutting edge risky technology, but they'll say, you know what, we're not going to give you the whole $1.5 million or $1.1 million all at once. So we want you to do a small pilot feasibility project that'll provide enough data for us to make a better decision in supporting the larger $1 million project. So that's your guidelines. Each agency, with the exception currently of NIH, will put out limits. And those limits might be, for example, for the Army, not to exceed $80,000 for a phase one and not to exceed $750,000 for a phase two. I think National Science Foundation is currently not to exceed $150,000 for a phase one, $500,000 for a phase two. National Institutes of Health, in their omnibus solicitation, which is their big solicitation that covers most of their $650 million budget, has guidelines. And those guidelines are $150,000 for a phase one, about $1 million for a phase two, but you can actually get more if you need it and can justify it. And the averages that NIH awards are slightly higher than those numbers.
And you find this out by talking to the program official, which you can find. I'm going to provide some links. If you go to futuresinbiotech.com, I'll provide some of the links where you can start. I suppose grants.gov is a good place to start.
Right. I'll tell you what, a better place to start. Actually, I'm going to give you two other websites that I think are a better place to start. And I'll tell you partly because grants.gov, which is the federal portal for applying for grants of all types, not just research grants, but arts grants and housing grants, only represents grants. And the SBIR program actually has both grants and contracts. So if you go to grants.gov, you might not find everything. What you're better off doing is going to www.sbir.gov. And that's a National Science Foundation-sponsored portal. And on that website, you'll find a couple of things that can be very helpful. You'll find an easy way to link through to all 11 agencies. So you'll find a federal agency's link.
Bert, can you please bring this up on the screen? So we're going to go to www.sbir.gov.
Yes.
Bert is listening. There we go.
There it is. And so, you know, about 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth tab across says federal agency links. And across the top, there you go. And that brings down a list of all of the federal agencies with SBIR dollars. And so, and you'll see, for example, right near the top, I can't see it too well, but the Department of Defense shows up towards the top. And you'll see underneath that, there's all the different components within the Department of Defense as well. So this can get a little complicated. But if you start out with the kind of the big picture, the Department of Defense is an example. These links will take you to each agency's SBIR website. And on those websites, you will be able to find a ton of information. A couple of pieces of advice that I give folks just starting out is take the time to just give yourself some time to just play and look at the different agencies. Each agency will have two things that can be very helpful to you. Three, they'll have a description and background of their particular SBIR program. They'll let you know when they release solicitations and what type of solicitation. They have archives of solicitations, so you can look back to previous solicitations, which will start to give you a very good idea of the types of things that that agency has put out in prior years. The other thing, which I think is extremely powerful, is they maintain databases. Department of Defense has one, National Institutes of Health has one, National Science Foundation does, that contains either lists or abstracts of all of the previously funded projects. So you can look at 20 years history of what other companies have gotten successfully funded through SBIR. And by just spending time doing that, you'll start to get a really good idea of what types of projects are funded, and you'll start to find agencies that are appropriate to fund you. The other thing I tell my folks all the time, there's some interesting things about human nature I've learned in working with people in developing proposals. And we tend to want to rely on our intuition. And part of the reason is because, unfortunately, you're going to see if you find one of these solicitations, the instructions can be 100 or 200 pages long. And so people think, oh, I don't want to read the instructions. I'll rely on my intuition, which is very problematic. But when you're still doing your upfront research or your upfront homework on what agencies, you know, you might make some assumptions as to what, for example, the Department of Defense might or might not be interested in funding just based on what you think defense-related technologies are. And when you go into those databases, you're going to find all kinds of things that you wouldn't have expected being funded by agencies like Department of Defense or, on the other side, National Institutes of Health.
Well, the DOD funds breast cancer.
DOD has funded breast cancer. National Institutes of Health, for example, has funded development of e-learning technologies for hazardous waste handlers. Yeah, I just that's an odd one. You know, why would you think of, you know, National Institutes of Health on that one? So it's a little bit all over the map. And when you look at agencies like National Science Foundation, whose mission is to promote science, education, and the national welfare, that mission's huge. You know, there's a ton of stuff that can fit under that National Science Foundation umbrella. So you got to do your homework. This is not, if you're thinking, I got a great idea, I can run to my Secretary of State, set up a company, and dash out a proposal, doesn't happen quite that easily. You have to set up that company, then you got to do a lot of legwork. Understand your customer, understand the agency, find a solicitation, read it five times, and then find someone who's familiar with the process to help you navigate. Writing grants and contract proposals requires a lot of discipline and a lot of attention to detail. But once you start to do it and once you get your first success, then it can be a very compelling form of money.
I remember when the editor of a journal called Neuroscience came to Yale and gave a talk. He presented data, preliminary data, that was suggesting that this one protein in the brain was responsible for all the brain swelling. And I raised my hand and asked, is anybody, you know, developing a drug for that protein? He said, no. And I was like, oh my God, how come this is, millions of people are dying. You guys aren't doing the drug. Just go, well, I could do it. We had very important, our biggest helper was our program official, who through hours of conversation helped us formulate a research program because he knew we had the expertise to do the project, but he really wanted the project done. And so he helped us formulate, you know, and answer all the questions on the entire process. So I'm very grateful for his help. But he's no longer doing that job. But the program officials were extremely happy. He talked us through all the elements of the application. which was incredible.
So that says to me, Mark, that you're different than a lot of the people that I work with, because I'll tell you something else that we learned about human nature through this, and is that when people don't like to talk to strangers. And the other thing we all think is, and a great it wasn't a joke, but the woman who used to run the NIH's SBIR program used to stand up at conferences and say, "We're the government, we're here to help." And it would always get a laugh. But in fact, what you point out is really... Yeah, it's really, 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 and there's like another really on there, important. Each agency that has an SBIR program has associated SBIR program staff. They're organized differently. NIH program directors have slightly different constraints, and you approach them a little differently than Department of Defense technical points of contact. But every agency have SBIR-specific folks, and they are absolutely there to help you. The most current National Science Foundation solicitations require or request, they don't require, I wish they did, request that you contact the appropriate program director. There's a list of about 8 of them, based on different technologies. And the second page of the solicitation says, contact the appropriate one by email, write a 2-3 page executive summary of your project and send it to them for their feedback, which is huge. And then if they're engaged, just as you said, they're going to work very hard to try and make sure that they provide you with the right guidance and insight within the constraints that they can. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the agencies get a lot of proposals. They do not want to review proposals that are not appropriate for them. So it's to their benefit as well as to yours for them to get enough of an idea of what you're doing, that if they think it's completely inappropriate for their solicitation, they're going to tell you so that they don't waste their time and yours. And if they do get engaged in what you're doing, I've had countless numbers of clients funded by the National Institutes of Health as an example, where the program directors are their champions. And because an agency like National Institutes of Health uses what we call external peer review. So when you put in a proposal to NIH, those program directors aren't the direct reviewers. There's an outside panel, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been reviewers for agencies like NIH and NSF. So because there's outside peer review, those program directors have flexibility to give you input to help you either make your proposal better or to tell you, you know, maybe this isn't exactly what you should be doing. So it's absolutely worth your time to get to know the program directors at the agencies.
Well, don't they have like a tremendous, on the one hand, they have a tremendous experience with SBIRs, much like you. I mean, if I come to you and ask you, is this going to fly? If you've overseen, 200 SBIRs in the last 2 years, and you've seen which ones got funded, which didn't, you have an institutional memory, right? And those program officials have an institutional memory. You're going to save yourself hours, days, weeks of work if they say, that's not a good idea. But you know what we really do need is this. And that's really just a different version of it.
Yeah, you got to be careful. One thing, I find that sometimes people ask the questions in the wrong way. They ask the questions to try and elicit the answer they want. The other thing you have to be careful with, depending on the agency, is if you say, should I submit a proposal? That's kind of or will this be funded? That's an even worse question. They can't make those kind of commitments, right? So depending on the agency, you're going to have to frame your question in such a way, for example, is this particular project within the scope of what your institute or what your agency would be interested in? Is this particular technology area responsive to the topic? That kind of question. So, and if they say no, that doesn't say your proposal is bad. It says, no, this topic is incorrect. So you don't put them on the spot of saying, will you fund me? And if they say, yes, this is responsive, that doesn't mean they'll fund you. You could write a terrible proposal, but at least they're responding and saying, yeah, that technology is within the scope of what we'd be interested in. So you have to be careful how you frame your question.
Well, if it's in the scope, and you don't get it, you need to practice and get better at it. Your writing skills need to improve and your whole... logic or experience in putting grantsmanship needs to get improved. But that being said, if they say that it's a fundable type project under the scope of their program, then you've got a lot of potential there. And it's up to you to meet up the potential and write a grant that's so strong that nobody can deny that this is fundable, that the reviewers do that. So let's talk a little bit about the application itself. Or do you have any other directions you'd like to take this? We have about 10 minutes left. I'm thinking if people know that this isn't a 100-page application, you know, it's about 20 hours to write, 30 hours to write, plus, there are 15 hours of admin time, 20 hours to... What are your thoughts?
I don't know that for someone who's got a lot of experience in writing proposals, maybe in your third or fourth one, you might be able to get by with 20 or 30 hours. My experience has been a little bit more than that. A proposal, depending on the agency, the meat of a proposal will be 10 to 20 pages. There's an awful lot of supporting documentation that some of the agencies require. But, you know, there's really five things that you're going to have to tell the agency. You got to tell a story. And the people who are really good proposal writers, grantsmen, tell their story in the exact way in which the agency wants to hear it. And every agency will give you a framework. They'll give you outlines. They'll give you recommended sections. And this is not the opportunity to be a creative writer, or this is not the opportunity for you to say, oh, I can't tell my story that way. I got to tell it differently. So the story you have to tell is, and I'll kind of go through the five things. You have to tell me why I should care. We refer to this in general as the significance of what you're doing. You have to establish before anything else what is significant about your project, what important problem it's going to solve. So why it would be important for me, NIH, or me, National Science Foundation, to spend my money on you. Once you establish the significance, the next thing you have to do is you have to tell me who the people are that are going to be doing the work, because the qualifications of the team that you put together, and by the way, SBIR is unlike some of the basic research grant mechanisms that I'm sure a lot of your listeners are used to writing. SBIRs are much more interdisciplinary team science. We're now not understanding the mechanism of a particular molecule. We're trying to productize it, for example, and turn it into a drug. So we need scientists, engineers, software folks. It's always a team. So the qualifications of your team. I have to know what you're going to do. I have to know your, so we refer to that as your approach, your methodologies. And that tends to be where scientists find their comfort zone in writing up their scientific and technical methods. But good approach in the absence of a significant problem you're trying to solve is not enough to get you funded. And then we have to know where you're going to do the work, or your environment, your resources, your research facilities. And all of those things have to come together. So it's telling the story of there's an important problem. It's significant. It's significant in the market. It's significant to the agency. You have significant innovative, it's technology, innovation, science. You have a strong team. You can develop a product that'll solve this problem based on this innovation. And you've got the necessary facilities and resources to do that job. And that's the story you're going to tell. You've got a budget to go along with it. But if you can tell that story and match your budget numbers to it, and you can tell that story in a concise and straightforward way, that's moving towards good grantsmanship.
Well, you know, I kind of see this. The Futures in Biotech has really been about, you know, firsthand scientific accounts. And those scientific accounts relate to science that inevitably will change, you know, lives in a sort of modern medicine. But that's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. This show, if you... you listen carefully, there's elements here that could change your life today and create your own job around your own talents and bring your talents and allow you to use your talents to translate technologies and bring them to market. And it's a hell of a lot of fun. Do you have any examples of projects that you can talk about? Or I guess you're kind of like a lawyer bound by secrecy.
Oh, man. So I'm trying to think off the top of my head without just, and you're right, every single client that we work with, we treat, you know, it's extremely proprietary, the specific things that they're doing. But, I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. We've got so many. You know, we've worked on lots of therapeutics. So, you know, we tend to focus mostly in biotech and life sciences, although not exclusively. You know, the example I gave you earlier of we worked with someone who had previously worked in industry as a health and safety officer and was specializing in e-learning. And they took that technology and turned it into methodologies to meet certain compliances for folks who worked with hazardous waste, and were able to get that funded through the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences at NIH. We've got examples of, I've got a lot of behavioral methodologies these days are getting funded at NIH. We've got a client who's a clinician who's got methodologies for working with autistic children. And there's great enthusiasm on the part of both NIH and him to see if this technology can work. So it's when folks take their science and they find really compelling needs in the market that you know, you make it sound really fun, Mark, to do it from a scientific perspective. You know, the one thing I think that I can't stress enough, I started out saying this at the beginning, and if there's one single biggest, hugest watch out I would tell scientific and technical entrepreneurs is avoid thinking that the hard part is the science and all I need to do is build it and they will come. Doing the science is hard, but if you don't acknowledge that the commercialization piece is extremely difficult as well, which is what one of the hard things about SBIR, and I don't know that we've stressed it enough today, is that it brings really together two things. It brings together cutting edge, innovative technologies that will enable amazing things to happen in the future, but it has to be paired with sound commercial opportunity, a way to actually sell something to a customer for money. And you have to pull those two things together, because for SBIR to fund science just for science sake isn't the goal, because it doesn't get to commercialization. And to fund a product that's not based on hardcore science to commercialize, the government's not going to spend their money doing that. Let other forms of money do it. So it's bringing those two things together. So the most successful scientific entrepreneurs that we work with open up their brains and say, okay, I've done half of the really hard stuff and I need money to keep going on the science, but I need to secure resources to help me on the commercialization side too, so that I can really tell a great story about how I can solve problems.
Well,
I don't think I answered your question about an example, but I'm still thinking.
That's okay. Well, I can give my example. I'm working on drugs to treat brain swelling, and there's no way a VC would come in at this early stage, and it allows us to do discovery science. It allows us to do development science and engineering. And it's really an engineering application to what is known out there in the scientific world. So it's translational. And it's... we've got the support we need, and I feel very honored and lucky to have that support. And we sort of are respectful to the source of the funding, which is the American people, and that agency. Now, the one thing that helps you, I think, understand that business side, as you were saying, because it's fairly naive just to think that it's the science that's the hard part. Well, the commercialization has to be rationalized, and if you don't have a good market commercialization plan, it's not going to make any sense. But it's my belief that science that is worth doing, that's going to have a societal impact to move society forward and help quality of life, or save lives, or facilitate things like facilitate learning, or even just be a valuable move of technology into a way that's more energy efficient. There's so many different angles. The way that it's going to be, if it has a positive societal impact, there'll be a commercialization plan that will match it. And then it's up to you to write that commercialization plan, right? People need to eat. They need to live. They need to survive. They need to be clothed. They need to have energy, to provide heating for their home. They need a home. And I guess that, if it's going to have a positive societal impact, there's a commercialization plan there. So that's the thing is, as a scientist, I don't write commercialization plans. The incubator, BioEnterprise here in Cleveland, writes them for us, because they they are very, very good at it. And we're fortunate to have them support us that way. There are people out there that are very good commercialization plans. And if you're a scientist or an engineer, it's great to form a team with people that can. But not to despair, right? You don't want to despair.
Oh, not at all. Oh, no, not at all. I don't want to discourage. But what I do want to do is bring a sense of, when you talk about enabling scientific discoveries and impact, you got to remember that SBIR is 2.5% of the extramural research budgets of all these agencies. So there's huge amounts of money going to support all the underlying scientific enabling discoveries. So what SBIR really proposes to do, and I think it's important to note, that a project that might be appropriate for other kinds of, the other 97.5% of the research dollars that the federal government puts out, it's all that enabling technology that certain, kind of pearls of it can bubble up into what can be reduced into products that small businesses are well suited to develop. And so we got to think about the SBIR money is the tip of this big iceberg. And it's the tip of the iceberg that'll take certain pieces of this technology that have a kind of midterm, 3 to 5 year ability to productize and get them out an impact in the market. That's not to say that the only that there aren't other really compelling technologies that need to be developed and funded, but SBIR needs to really productize it. So what I just don't like the scientists to do is think that it's only about the science. And it's folks just like you, when you find a place like BioEnterprise that's able to bring the commercialization resources to your, you know, depth of scientific expertise and knowledge, that's when you really get a powerful combination. So when there are communities that provide that kind of infrastructure support to scientists that are spinning technologies out, some universities do now with their tech transfer for offices. A lot of economic development organizations do. And then the entrepreneurial infrastructure. You know, other entrepreneurs, there's a group here in Ann Arbor that spun out of Pfizer, funded by some VCs, that started a new pharmaceutical company that ultimately, after many years and many millions and millions of dollars of both, they got some SBIR, but mostly venture capital, they got reacquired by Pfizer, and that spawned five new entrepreneurs here in the Ann Arbor community, all off doing new biotech and pharma startups, all coming to us now for help writing grants to kind of do it again. And that's when you start to build the infrastructure. You want to look for those kind of folks to say, okay, you've done it before. I've got this great science. Let's work together to move this forward. So just to acknowledge that it's about the science plus.
Well, academics that are listening, I'd like just to point out that the pay lines compared to an R01 for this, before we get to pay lines, actually, this is a way for you to get your science from the bench that has come from an R01 into the clinic, right? Or if you're an engineer, into the world of whatever you're working on. go ahead.
No, go on.
Yeah, and the pay line for an R01 is typically, it's getting hard, between 5 and 8%, sometimes even lower. Yeah. I think the NDS went down to 3 or 4%. So you have to write 20 grants to get one funded, or just be very, very, very good, or which is not a bad thing to aim for. But but so the SBIR programs are, what is the range of pay line?
So it's agency specific, but since you're talking about R01s, which are specific to the National Institutes of Health, the NIH pay lines for SBIR phase ones, they fund about 22 to 24% of the phase ones they get and about 35 to 40% of the phase twos. So it's significantly higher than R01s, R03s, R21s. Other agencies tend to be more around between the 10 and the 20%. Range for phase ones, and almost all the agencies are between 35 and 40% for phase twos. So if you think about it, if you can get your foot in the door by getting that phase one feasibility study funded, you've got close to, not quite, but close to a 50% chance in some cases of getting that phase two funded, which is 2 years and $1 million. So it's some pretty significant money.
Or more.
or more. You can write two or three of them. Yeah.
Or yeah, absolutely. Or yeah, yeah. I remember my program official saying, "Oh, those are 11-year-old policies at the NINDS. We do this, right?" So the numbers were different a little bit. And the Cancer Institute also, while the phase one is fairly traditional, you can rationalize much, much more. It depends on the scope of the science. You don't want to necessarily say, "I need $10 million to bring a drug to clinic in a phase one." You have to do your early stage high risk stuff as a phase one and move it forward to a couple of subsequent phase twos. How could people reach you?
How can they reach me?
Yeah, they can.
So our website is www.bioconsultants.com or bbcetc.com. Either one will work. So you can bioconsultants.com or bbcetc.com. My email, lisa@bioconsultants.com. LISA, lisa@bioconsultants.com. That'll work as well.
Any final comments? Any ideas that we missed that now are coming?
I'm known as the crazy woman who runs around three quarters of this country screaming at people to write SBIRs and help get their technologies funded. I am a huge fan of this source of capital. I'm a little bit sanguine when people, are over, anxious and think it's all about my great idea. But for those of you developing high-risk technologies where there's a very compelling commercial application and are willing to do a little bit of legwork to understand what the agencies want, it is absolutely worth your time to explore SBIR funding, because the government wants to see high-risk technology innovation from small companies make it through to market. Ultimately, it's economic development. It's great for the United States. It's great for technology-based entrepreneurs. So I spend most of my time running around the country trying to convince people to do this. So I encourage folks to spend a little time to look into it and see if it might make sense. It's great money if it's appropriate and you can get it.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Our guest today was Lisa Kurek, and she's managing partner at Biotechnology Business Consultants in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you very much for your insight. You're helping create
jobs.
Thanks
very much, Mark. You know, it's a pleasure. I hope so. That would be great.
Well, the government's creating jobs, right? They're saying we're going to try to create jobs. And this is one of the ways they do it, at least for the scientific community and the engineering community. So
huge
out there,
way.
We got to do
our
part. We got to do our part.
We're all about innovation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Bert McQuinn for handling the audio and video boards and recordings today. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible. Leah Laporte, Lisa Kenzel, Frederic Louis, Ken Shepherdson, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Salina, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Pelze and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at markmarc@twit.tv. Again, that's Mark Pelze, or markmarc@twit.tv. Or on Twitter, markmarcpelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelze.